Introducing Manor Wisdom Quintet!
Week number two back, and speaking of back, I just got back from my niece's 9th birthday party. It was a rager, so many drugs, so much debauchery. It was insane. Anyway, it was very loud. But this week I've got Jen Polansky on, and I didn't know Jen at all. The only thing I knew about Jen was that she had the same name as my wife, and Jen did this interview from a hotel room because she was traveling at the time, and her husband was in the background. He did a very good job of being quiet most of the time, but you'll hear a reference to him, and I even think you hear him in the background at one point, but, you know, that's why there's another man's voice on this podcast. Yeah. Anyway, it was a great interview. One of those people I could have probably easily done another hour with, because I just found that we had a lot in common. There was a lot of interest from me to get to know somebody like her because of her background, as you're going to hear in this podcast. So very fun, very good chat, one that I hope to follow up on, not just on a podcast level, but on a personal level too. So really fun to talk to her. So Jen Polansky, this week on the chat. A couple of things to discuss. Number one, you know, make sure you join the Patreon. It's still there. I do have a couple people that follow and for some reason pay a monthly fee, and you know, I'm very appreciative of that. I'm flattered by it. But you get everything without ads on the Patreon. And once I get things going a little smoother, I'll put exclusive content on there, more exclusive content. I did when I first started. There's some playwrights that I interviewed that still haven't been posted publicly that are only on that Patreon page. So join the Patreon. It's in the bio. Purchase a shirt. A couple of people did this past week. I appreciate you for supporting the podcast, but that's kind of how I pay them the annual fee. So I don't hustle or push the shirts very often. I only push them probably about once a year, and that's to help cover that annual fee because it is a little lofty for a podcast that does not make a dime off of ads. So yeah, if you want to do that, help me out, you know what I'm saying? If you find that I'm being a little more NPR-ish when I do my introductions, it's because I'm in a shared space now, and everyone in my house can hear me do this. So although they know I'm doing it, there's still a part of me that's kind of embarrassed, you know what I'm saying? One Act Plays in full swing. I did a contest last week out Caldwell High School, thanks to Chase for having me out. It was a lot of fun. I will tell you, it was probably more fun doing that than it was contest managing or obviously being a part of it, partially because it was like stress-free. And I was only there to sort of tech direct and be helpful to students to help make sure, and I even posted online, you know, make sure they didn't go crazy in the booth. And it's one of those jobs, as I used to call my tech students in certain situations. I used to say, you're like a firefighter. You hope that you're not busy, but you do sit around, and if something does happen, you have to know how to solve it and make the situation less stressful for everyone around. And so that's kind of what my job was. And there were a couple of instances where a student had moments of almost panic, right? And they were able to sort of get things under control and figure things out. One situation with a student during their show that I didn't make known to anybody that was at that contest. It was just me and the student. I think that student did share it with their director, but he had forgotten to record some very important cues in the show, and so I helped him kind of get through that. And it was it's important, you know, it's important that we look at these contests not as like an I gotcha. I hate that. I absolutely hate that. I had a student years ago, Samantha, that really, really, she was so dead set on writing a letter to UIL because another school's prop had fallen off the stage and they didn't get that prop. And she was sure that that would be disqualifiable and we would move on. And even though we weren't chosen to move on, and it was just, I was like, this isn't about getting it. Like, we're going to go home and enjoy it. Well, she won't enjoy some Mai Tais. Now she is. She's almost 30, but I think. But anyway, you know, it's like, we're going to go home and enjoy our life while these other people are going to stress out and keep going on with one act play. It's not that big of a deal. It's theater, you know? And that's how I just kind of treat every contest. And I was even told by another director when I was contest managing that they liked what I was doing because it just, it didn't add stress to the contest, So, that's kind of what my role is. And I'm a big believer in that, whether it's right or wrong. I'm a big believer that you just don't add stress. I kind of learned that from Jay. Jay is like the least, like he just doesn't add stress to anything. That dude is, you know, awesome. But anyway, I digress. Enough about Jay. You'll hear Jay later in the coming months because we're going to, or in the coming weeks because we're going to do a WrestleMania podcast. We're going to bring that back. Yes, brother. I want to quickly say, because I did go back, you know, I did the hang at Caldwell High School for the one act play hang, and I wasn't happy with how it turned out. And the main reason is it had nothing to do with the school, or it has nothing to do with anything other than like the architecture of the school and the hanging positions. And you know, I this was early in my Blake Minor design days, and I need to make sure I have certain amenities, accoutrements with me to make sure that these light hangs and the focus and everything is perfect, because that's what I'm getting paid to do. But I want to go back. You know, this is one of those schools that I would go back for free to kind of fix things up a little bit. But there are a couple of schools that I've done these one act play hangs in, and I quickly realize there's only so much you can do. The Caldwell's not one of those, but I quickly realize in some place, although Caldwell could use, and if you want to donate to Operation Hang a Third Electric, I would highly encourage you. But anyway, I digress. But there are quite a few schools that I don't have a lot of control over. They don't have the gear, or they don't have the cabling, or they don't have the hanging positions, or, you know, a lot of these schools, for some weird reason, the catwalk, this is not an indictment on the director, it's an indictment on the architect, but the catwalks don't extend far enough to get the edges of the stage, or you have a round catwalk with a straight stage, and so your the you know, the far right and left portions of the catwalk are super close to the stage compared to the center. So it's a lot of different variables, man, and it sucks because my name is on that stuff, and I take a lot of pride in that, and I don't want people to think that, oh, this guy thinks he's hot stuff and he doesn't know nothing. I don't. Anyway, hire me though. I've got some dance shows coming up. I've got obviously some one act play contests through April 3rd. I've got one act play, and then some dance stuff, and you know, things start to slow down, but I'm around. Give me a shout. You know, you make me wanna. But yeah, Jen Polanski this week again. Join the Patreon, like me, friend me on Facebook, shoot me a message in Facebook, email me, whatever you want to do, but let's chat. Also, if you want to be on the pod, reach out to me. I would love to have you on, and let me know what kind of Blake Minor design swag. Do I have any friends out there that can, like, print some stuff that I don't have to pay an arm and a leg? I went on to Custom Ink, and girl, this stuff is expensive, and I'm brand new, you know what I'm saying? Anyway, Bobby, break a leg this spring break. I hope you break your leg this spring break, Bobby. How's that? Enjoy Jim Polanski.
I grew up outside of Washington, D.C. in the suburbs, and I was, I don't know, fascinated with theater from the time I could remember. I come from a family of artists. So my sisters are painters and jewelry makers, and my brother really wanted to be a musician, and my mother was a teacher. And now lots of people in my family are teachers, which is kind of fun. In all walks of life, I have a sister who runs an education program for a small museum in Virginia. And I have another sister who teaches art, and I taught theater in the classroom. And I found along the way in that journey that the classroom was probably not where I excelled the most. I mean, I can do it, but there are people who do it better. that was an interesting journey to sort of learn that. Like, I came to teaching late. I think I was 46 when I got certified in the state of Texas to teach. So what did I do before that? Well, I went to college. I convinced my parents in high school that theater was a viable career, and consequently put up with years of, are you sure you can get a job in this? Are you really sure you can make a living? And I'm like, yes, I'm making a living now. Like, I'm in high school, I'm employed, I'm working in theater, it's going to be okay. I had that absolutely invincible conviction that you have at 19, that you have all the answers and you knew exactly what's going to happen and it's going to be okay, right? And by the time I got through college, I was probably a lot less certain. I certainly knew that I could make a living, but I no longer was living that fantasy of, I am going to light the world on fire and I'm going to be the next best lighting designer and it's going to be awesome. And yeah, I remember looking at my college professors who were telling us that we were all going to be the next amazing generation. And I'm like, yeah, the 10 guys who do all the Broadway design, they're not dead yet. So I don't know what it is you think we're going to do, but it's probably not that. If we're lucky, we'll wind up assisting those people. And I'm actually a very good lighting design assistant, but it's really a tough way to make a living because those are people who do tons and tons of work and get very little pay. It is a stepping stone career. And it's something that I think if you're serious about that aspect of the business, you definitely should spend some time assisting people, but you can't make a living doing that. Like, that's not a career unto itself. That is a how you get to the next step. So I did a little bit of designing in Washington, D.C., and I did a little bit of lots of other things to make ends meet. And I wound up being, it's interesting, I went to school and I studied lighting design, and I wound up practically working as a master electrician for a couple small ballet companies. And that was fun. That was lots of fun. There's really nothing that's more exciting when you're 22 or 23 and you get to travel. And it doesn't matter that it's not glamorous travel. You get to go places and do stuff and you are solving problems and it's amazing, right? And you're getting paid for all of this. Like, you've never made money before, and that's amazing. And I loved that aspect of my job while it lasted. I fell into contact with IATSC Local 22 in Washington, D.C., and a couple of ins and outs of the Kennedy Center with one of these companies. And I was kind of like, these guys have got it going on. They are making all the money and they have all the benefits and I have none of that. Wait a minute. So in 1996, I joined Local 22 and had a fantastic romp for about 15 years. I worked for them for a couple of years before I formally became a member. And you know, I joined and I paid my dues and I worked my way through the system, which was kind of minimally organized when I started working for them. And by the time I left them, it was very organized. And I was part of that. For 5 years, I ran their testing and training department. So that was maybe the first dabble into education. And that was exciting and scary. And I remember having a conversation with Walter Cahill, who was my business agent at the time, and saying, hey, Walter, I need your help. Like, I didn't know how to run a meeting. And I just had a meeting with all those people and it was a complete disaster. So I need help. You know? How do I actually run a meeting? And he sat down and he was like, well, okay, so there's some things you can do, you know? And it really was, it was an amazing learning experience. And I am actually very proud of the fact that that structure that all those people helped me build, that's still kind of the backbone of how Local 22 trains its stagehands. Like Local 16 in San Francisco, we tried to model on a lot of their practices. So we offered lots of classes and lots of practical training and eventually grew to offering mentorships to people. And then we gave an exam. And apparently now they give the exam more than once a year. But once a year, we begged the Kennedy Center for use of their theater. And we had a written test. And then we had this massive practical exam and tons of volunteers. And we ran people through all the practical skills of being a stagehand, from how to carry truss safely from one place to another, to things like, well, how you reeve the control line for a draw curtain, and how do you properly weight a line set, and what's the tie-off that we use? Because we still had some non-counterweight houses. Ford's Theater was a sandbag. At that time, National Theater was still a sandbag house. Both of those spaces have converted to automated rigging, so I couldn't tell you what the test looks like now. You know, are we teaching people how to field strip CM chain motors? I don't know. but we covered everything. And it took a phenomenally long time. And administering that practical test at the upper levels. So we had like an A and B list when I started, and then it was an A, B, C, D list when I left. and creating that program and maintaining that was really, really interesting. And absolutely, there were some conflicts and some controversy along the way. But, you know, overall, it was an amazing effort by people. I had this huge committee of like 12 people, and these were the folks who just wanted to make it better, make it safer. And this is long before OSHA 10, OSHA 30. You know, I remember doing rock and roll jobs where at 2 o'clock in the morning, nobody's wearing a hard hat, you know, where the worst thing that happened was the rigger that dropped a shackle pin onto the ice floor got grounded for the day, but not fired. Now you make a mistake like that, and I think, you know, it will cost you your job because there's so many people who want to do that stuff. So there's been a process of that. It was the best job that I had. I absolutely loved being a union stagehand. I was a huge advocate for the union and what it can do for people. And I'm still that way. And I live now in one of the horrifying right to work states. So that's, you know, doing that work in Texas is a whole different deal. And I actually, when I got married and I had a kid and I decided I really kind of needed a different sort of life, because it's very hard to raise a child and do that work where you're working every night and every holiday. So when I married and we moved to Texas, I sat down with the local business agent in Dallas and I went into sticker shock. Because the economics of living in Texas and the economics of living in Washington, D.C. are really different, really different. And I had learned to think about money very differently. You know, that was actually one of the huge benefits of working in the gig economy. I learned how to think about money in smaller chunks, perhaps, than people normally do. Right now, as a public school teacher in Texas, I get paid once a month. But I am used to, okay, I worked 4 hours and I'm going to get that check in 30 days. And I worked 2 jobs at the Kennedy Center and those checks will come next week and that'll pay the rent. And then I learned to do those calculations all the time. And a very, very good friend of mine on my very first show out of college taught me to pay yourself first. And he was really adamant about that. And it's a habit that I'm really grateful for because it got me through some really crazy times in my life. But even if paying yourself means you're putting $2 into savings, that adds up very quickly. And it did, you know, and that was amazing. So through Local 22, I got to do fabulous things that I never would have done in any other job. I worked in the White House. I did inaugural balls. I have shaken hands with 5 presidents. I've met really amazing, famous people at the Kennedy Center Honors who would never remember me from anybody, but it was really cool to shake hands with Sean Connery, right? And it was really cool to see Tina Turner. It was really, really neat to be in those places. I worked a Broadway gig for a little while because I made friends with, you know, DC is this place that is kind of an out-of-town tryout stop for a lot of people. So Man of La Mancha did its kind of out of town rest stop there. They took over the National Theater for 8 weeks. And I was the like substitute lighting programmer. I got to work with Paul Gallo. I got to work with John McKernan. I got to work with Ken Billington. You know, these amazing people. That was really, really neat. I did a museum job at the Museum of American Women, and it was a Julie Taymor retrospective, and Don Holder came down from New York to light the exhibit. That was super cool to get to work with him and to see all the amazing, fabulous stuff that they had on display for Julie Taymor. So I did things that I never thought would come my way. And I did not miss, I didn't really miss being a designer. I think that was one of the maturity things that happened to me after college, was that I really didn't think that was the definition of success anymore. And I learned something about myself along the way between college and trying to make it as a regional designer. And that was that light's a very ethereal thing to work with. It's really hard to talk to people about it, and people don't know how to talk to you about it. So I have directors who are like, make it magic. And I'm thinking, oh, that's such bullshit. That doesn't mean anything. That doesn't tell me what you want. You know? So, and you really don't have time to build that trust with people where you speak each other's language. You have to work with people again and again. And I just wasn't getting that opportunity. I currently work in Texas at a high school with my best friend on the planet, who's a theater director, and I have been her technical director for a number of years. And we've worked together so long now that we finish each other's sentences. And she has just stopped talking to me about some aspects of the show because there is trust. There is this, well, I know that Jennifer will make that beautiful for me. So I'm not even gonna bother her with that because I gotta go fix this thing. So I am really lucky in that regards. I love what I do now. I loved what I did in my 20s and my 30s, and I absolutely love what I'm doing right now. So along the way, in my journey of becoming a classroom teacher and then deciding that maybe that was not a really great career for somebody who's a little short on patience and a little too connected to the values of the real world, education is not the real world. And the children that we teach now are definitely, you know, there's always the generation gap, but even I am seeing the very distinct pre-COVID, post-COVID gap in my students. And the post-COVID kids think about the world entirely differently. And the things that we do in live theater, I think, are less appealing to them. So that's kind of sad to me. And I work for a school system that is struggling to keep its theater programs afloat. And is currently grappling with, do we offer theater at middle school at all? Like, is there really genuinely any interest? And the number of students that I work with in a high school who are like, but it's like a movie, right? You just kind of go, no, have you seen a live show? Oh, wait. Yeah, no. So the vast majority of my students, even when I worked in more affluent school districts, they just have not seen live theater. It's really not as strong a part of the culture. And it made me really appreciate my own childhood because my mother took me to the museums and she took me to the symphony and I got to see the opera when I was 15. And that was what did it for me. I was like, oh my gosh, I want to do that. Yeah. Oh my gosh, opera's where it's at. There's all this money being spent. It's all amazing. And it just... you know, it's just not quite like that for kids. But when you can get them in front of live theater, it's amazing. So we participate in a grant with Dallas Theater Center called Project Discovery. And I get to take the kids to see between 5 and sometimes it's only 3 shows. This year, it's only 3 shows that we get to go see because Dallas Theater Center has another audience to please and they're not high school students. And some of the things that they pick are just really kind of not appropriate in the very conservative school district that I teach in. So some, you know, we don't get to go see Rocky Horror Picture Show. Well, that's okay. And we don't get to see Frankenstein because we were told that there would be nudity. And I get that. And we did not go see Hair because there was definitely nudity. And that nudity was a former instructor in my school. And I was like, no, I am not teaching, taking you all downtown to see that. That is not happening. You're going to go la, 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 not hearing that you're going to go see that on your own. I don't want to know. And I don't want to hear about it. So the theater is a very, very small world, and educational theater even more so. I have been privileged to sit in on some of the hiring interviews in my school district. And I had one principal look at me and go, "Do you all know each other?" And they were like, "Well, yeah, it's a small community and we all need lots of help. So yes, we all know each other. We all network all the time. You know, we all at least know each other's names." So that was kind of a fun experience. But I definitely enjoy that. My current position now is not in the classroom. I am the auditorium manager for the entire school district. So that means I work across all the schools. And I said this in my hiring interview with the then fine arts director, who's not with us any longer. They described what they wanted me to do. And I said, you know, it sounds like what you need is kind of a general technical director. And I said, and I can do that for you. I come with a lot of experience. And they're like, "Oh yes, you have a very impressive resume." And I'm thinking, yeah, but I'm talking about all the stuff that's not on the resume. I'm talking about all the stuff that doesn't fit in those little boxes. And I'm really grateful because my time in Local 22, you know, the advantage to sort of just being a stagehand on call is that you were thrown into whatever came your way that day. So maybe it was a hotel job and you were setting up some kind of meeting thing, or maybe you were going to the opera and you were going to build scenery for 2 weeks, or you were going down to Ford's Theater and you were going to load the show, or I got a last minute call to a hotel job that needed a programmer and it turned out to be the Mariposa Foundation. So I got to watch Carlos Santana play guitar all night long from about 6 feet away and make up lighting cues on the fly. It was fantastic. Just things like that come your way. Yeah. And so it made me a very flexible thinker and it made me a really good problem solver. And those are the things that I tell people all the time, that this is why you need theater in public education, because that's what it teaches the kids. It teaches them not only how to solve problems, but that they can solve problems. And I have so many students who just don't believe in their own abilities to do that. Do they build the most beautiful scenery in the world? Not always, but they try and they do it and they are in the shop doing things that they never thought they could do before. And I love that. I love being able to see that happen. My specialty is lighting. My sound has become kind of a subset of mine. And the fact that I know more about audio than anybody else in my school district scares the heck out of me. And it probably should scare everybody else, but I'm lucky enough to have built some relationships with local vendors. I have a really great local company that is doing training, like individualized training at all of my schools. And I'm just like, I went to my boss and I said, "We have to pay for this. We have to pay for this every year because this is outside the skill set of your teachers. Frankly, it's outside my skill set. And we have these wonderful professionals right over there and they'll do this for us. And $400 for a 3-hour session is really, really cheap." And we will gradually increase the pool of knowledge and it'll get better. But right now, public school teachers have so much they have to do. So many decisions to make every day. So many things that they are responsible for outside the classroom. And then to throw, "Hey, oh, by the way, you need to take at least one or two of your students and teach them all the fundamentals of live audio mixing for your show that opens in 3 weeks that you're doing 10,000 other things to do," right? You know? Yeah, no, that's just kind of not realistic. So one of the things I get to do is leverage the small budget that I control towards better training, towards opportunities for kids. And so to give 4 to 6 students at a school that kind of small group hands-on training with a professional, that's an amazing opportunity for them. I love that that is something that my school district can provide for students. I'm not training the next generation of stagehands. I'm not under any illusions about that, but I am training the next generation of problem solvers. I am training the next generation of kids who appreciate the arts. I am hopefully helping to build our next audience, because we all have to work on that. When I was living in DC, on a random whim, I went to see Billboards at Wolf Trap Arts Park. And I'd never seen the Joffrey Ballet do anything like that. And I was absolutely entranced by the entire production. But what was equally amazing to me was to sit and watch a ballet company, and most of the audience is under 30. And that's what's not usual. That's what was thrilling to me. It was like, oh my gosh, we've cracked the code. We've figured out how to make this look accessible to everybody. Great. Because we need these people, and we need them to come back again and again, and we need them to keep spending money on the arts so that we have arts to see in this country. You know, I'm lucky. I grew up in a place that had lots and lots of arts experiences on offer. And the arts culture in Dallas is a lot smaller than the arts culture in DC for a lot of different reasons. But trying to keep that alive, I feel like that's one of my missions, is to infect kids with that desire to go see performances. And I have a couple who will do that. I have one student who has decided that a career in theater is what they want. And they've got their families backing, and that's awesome. And I have another student who's asked me to come talk to parents and kind of explain, what does that look like? What does a career in the arts look like? And I'm like, well, you know, for me, it looked like $150,000 a year in New York City, you know, doing 8 shows a week. I don't know what to tell you. But trying to help people who are not artists themselves understand how viable this is. And I think that's part of the conversation that we need to be having in public schools, is that the arts are technology and accountability and the 100 soft skills you need to land a real job in this country, right? You know, if you're going to, there's a sign outside my theater and it says, we are Singley Academy. We are nurses and we are stagehands and we are stage managers and we are problem solvers and we are computer specialists. And we are scenic painters. And, you know, it's all of these things, because you learn all those things in the theater. And I have to keep spreading that message to students and parents alike, that, you know, theater is not just it's not just for people who are willing to stand up in front of their peers and say some memorized words. It's so much more than that. Yeah. And we have to keep telling people that it's more than that.
That was a TED talk right there. that was good. that was very good. Like that was, I'm not done with you, but that, if that ended right there, that would be like the perfect, that might've been one of the most perfect intros / stories ever. Cause it that was great. Now, there are a couple things that stood out to me that are, somewhat tongue in cheek a little bit, but for one, you said you're working with your best friend now, and I know your husband's in the room, so I hope he's not offended by what you said. But you know,
we call her my work wife.
Okay, there you go. Yeah. But anyway, you know, I thought that was funny. The other thing is, I do very little research on who I'm about to talk to. So if I've never ever talked to you or met you, I sometimes just go with, somebody said, hey, you should interview Jen Polansky. Like, and I'm okay, whatever. I trust you. Or it's somebody I've known for 10 years. Like you've said, it's a small world, theater education. So it's somebody I know. And so I know some things about them. Now, admittingly, I knew nothing about you other than that you and my wife share the same first name. So, you know, that's
about Jennifer. We're going to take over the world.
Yeah.
One
so
day.
Other than
I
that,
I collect friends who are named Jennifer.
My best friend, his name is Blake. That's not a joke. So, I get it. A lot of people are very confused when they think I'm talking to myself on the phone, but, my background is lighting as well. And I went to, my undergrad is in lighting, from UH with, Kevin Rigdon. And,
nice.
But I went to the performing arts school here in Houston and, befriended, a guy named Nick Phillips, and he was being groomed to be Ken Billington's kind of next in line. And so he is very, very tight with Ken Billington. But, so I've had the privilege to meet him as well. And that was one of those moments that, you know, in any other circle, Ken Billing, who's Ken, you know, but like in that, in right, the, yeah. right, yeah, in that lighting design circle, and in the, and even in just theater in general, it's, he's like royalty. And so when you said that name, I was like, okay, all right. So, that's pretty cool. So it's just something we share.
I have a funny name dropping story for you if you want.
Well, you already name dropped Santana and all kind of, I mean, keep going.
I went to the University of North Carolina School of the Arts.
Yep.
And there were a lot of changes being made to the program when, in the time that I graduated. And it's an amazing school, but the class that I graduated in was really sort of cutthroat competitive. And the school was very serious about turning out top-notch students. So 54 of us entered in the fall of 1989, and 17 of us graduated.
Yep.
17 people.
Yep.
There were six of us in lighting design, and up until spring break of my senior year, and suddenly there were four of us, they told two kids to take a hike, spring break. Wow. I was sort of like, But we all had to do thesis designs, and they wanted to introduce something to elevate the program. So I had Jennifer Tipton come and review my senior lighting design piece. Mm. And that was an experience. And I would have gotten so much more out of it if I had been in a different place, right. a different frame of mind. Right. I think that she does very interesting work, but it's very, very different from the aesthetic that I pursue personally.
Sure.
So they could not have found somebody who was like sort of more polar opposite of where I was going in terms of design.
Right.
And she invited me to come to Yale. And I turned her down, like looked at Jennifer Tipton and said, but I don't want to go anywhere. It's just like here.
Yeah.
Because really, is there anybody more arrogant than a 22-year-old who's about to graduate and has all of the answers, right? Yeah.
That's pretty funny. So, well, hey, good for you. You turned out all right. So, I mean, you know.
Well, I think even then I was questioning the viability of making a living as a lighting designer, sure. as just solely as a lighting designer. And one of the more interesting workshops that they put us through at School of the Arts was with, I cannot remember the name of the presenter, but the whole topic was, what are you going to do when you're not designing a show? And this guy posed a question that we really hadn't begun to think about yet. You know, you can't be designing 365 days a year. So what are your other skills, mm-hmm. and how do you market them? And what else are you going to do? Because you're not going to be designing all the time. And it really, that was probably one of the most useful things that I got out of that college. Well, that and the session on how to do your taxes in the entertainment industry, that was really useful too.
Right. Yeah. It's, you know, I'm in a place right now in my life, cause I'm a 13-year theater educator that took a break, went on tour, went back to teaching, and now I'm on a break again. And doing the independent gig thing, you know, so it's, I'm one of those believers that, if you're going to teach something, you should have, or you should be doing that something. Right. So, I've just always been that person. And I think in lighting and even audio, to an extent, you know, props and crafts as well, but not as much, but I feel like you have to kind of step away to figure out what's relevant again.
I have posited that to my school district before, that what I really wish I could do is take a sabbatical from my job and just go work for a year. The problem is I won't, the climate in education being what it is, if I quit, they'll just do away with my job.
Sure.
And that will be a huge disservice to the people that I work with.
Right.
Because they need somebody to do all that looking after. Right. High school theaters have become very complicated places. High school educators don't really have the knowledge or the time to look after them properly.
Right.
And so that is part of my job. But, you know, I got started in lighting in the very late 80s and saw all those changes happen in the 90s. And the LED revolution kind of happened without me.
Yeah.
So, you know, I have kind of a back door into some of that because my husband is in the industry. But I don't work hands-on with all that stuff anymore. And what I can teach my kids is limited sort of to what I have access to as a public school.
Yeah.
And that's not what we're using in the real world. And we can't, we're not a big 6A high school with a, you know, $20,000 budget to produce a musical, or really in the case of say JJ Pierce, we're not producing three musicals a year to the tune of $60,000 a piece.
Right.
That's just not our world.
Or,
so,
or Donnie at Richardson.
Yeah. You know, and, yeah. You know, and kudos to those guys because they are raising the bar and that's awesome.
Yeah.
But my school is not situated in a very affluent district and it's really very CTE focused. And, you know, and that's okay because there's lots of things that they do in CTE that we do in theater.
Right.
And that's really the conversation that we're having now. Texas is not one of those states where technical theater is a CTE subject.
Right.
It's a fine arts subject. So it's funded very differently. And I sometimes think that if we're going to service our students to the very best of our abilities, then we have to be in the CTE pathways because that's where the money is.
Right.
That's where the funding is.
So,
and theaters are enormously complicated places that need lots and lots of funding.
So how do you, I mean, how do you marry the two together since, you know, we use the word design in our trade, which is artistic in nature. But then, you know, repairing instrumentation and, having to pull out tools to not, obviously you pull out tools to build scenery, but I've got a car full of tools right now that I don't build scenery with. I have soldering irons and, you know, right. I have wrenches and I have all these things that, are yes, tools, but they're meant to supplement design work, if that makes sense.
Yes. No, it's actually, I don't find it all that difficult at all to integrate with the CTE pathways. My school teaches computer networking pathways and cybersecurity and programming and computer hardware and maintenance and information systems. And modern technical theater is one giant information system management project. And if you do anything in lighting right now, if you don't know networking, then modernized stage lighting is a little difficult to handle because everything is networked. Mm-hmm. And it's down to the nuts and bolts basics of if I need RJ45 connectors to get my source forward lights strung together, well, I've got kids who can build me those cables.
Yeah.
And all the tools for that are downstairs in that lab. So I have an advantage over some of my peers in that a lot of that is kind of built into the school that I work at primarily. But teaching kids, you know, I am vividly remembering my lighting design professor in college who said, if you don't know what an IC chip is and how to replace it, your job will be taken by the guy who has those skills.
Right.
And that's where we've come to now. That's,
right.
You know, when you think about the things that a professional stage electrician has to know how to do now and the level of problem solving that you have to master in that field. It's a whole different ballgame. And it's absolutely fascinating to me that like the guys who went off and studied computer science and then decided they still wanted a career in the arts, they're the ones who understand this all. They're the ones who have the advantage.
So
yes.
You mentioned, and I'm jumping around here a little bit, but you mentioned that,
that's okay.
You know, you didn't necessarily go the path you wanted to as a designer, partially because you weren't getting that repetitive production with, you know, or repeating with designer or excuse me, directors. I'll get my bearings about me at some point. and you know, and now you're working with somebody that you guys finish each other's sentences. And, you know, Kevin Rigdon, used to tell me that your blue is different than my blue and different than the person next to you, you know? And so when you say as a director, I want it to be blue, I'm going to give you the blue that I interpret. And you that, and if you don't think that that's the blue, if that's not the blue you want, then that sucks. And so that's where repetition comes in, getting to know that director. Right. And so my question, I guess, is if you aren't allowed to have that repetition, there are a lot of people that you said that there are a lot of people that feel this way about not knowing how to talk to a lighting designer, right? And not knowing the language to use and just saying, hey, I really want it to look cool, right? Well,
right. You know,
what does look cool mean? And so do you have sort of tips and tricks on how maybe new, not necessarily new to the industry, but new together as partners, director, designers can kind of create a conversation or have a productive dialogue with each other?
I think that absolutely you can. And I think probably the closest I got to that was working in summer stock. I worked as a designer in summer stock while I was in college. And so you're in the same environment, you're working with largely the same people. And that was easier. So like I worked at a place that did 9 shows in 9 weeks and they were all musicals. So that was a really tough schedule, but they really only employed 4 or 5 different directors. And after a couple summers there, I knew all those people and I knew how to talk to them. And we were all very, very short on time. So in that environment, there's a lot of get it done. I like that. No, I don't like that. Give me something else. Let's go back to that. What else you got? And you get used to very making rapid changes and picking up and discarding ideas very quickly. And as a designer, you're constantly trying to learn something new. And I learned some of that in college. I learned how to sort of try and think about things and articulate my ideas in a specific way. For years after I got out of college, I would meet people on the road. I would meet people coming through the theaters I was working in, and I'd be like, you went to school of the arts, because I know, because the way you talk, you know. And people are like, that's so bizarre, how do you know that, you know? We learned a very specific vocabulary and a way to talk about it, and I think you develop that relationship very quickly. Well, that's really kind of a misnomer. I don't think you develop any relationship quickly, but you very quickly learn that you have to assess whether or not your ideas are being accepted, or whether the person you're talking to even understands what you're trying to convey. And for me, it has always been a process of, let me show you this. And as a designer, I always feel like I have to have the thing I want to do, and then 2 or 3 ideas in my back pocket that are like, okay, well, I know this always works. And I know people always like the way this looks, and I can always do that. You talk to people who are like, who are Verilight programmers, who do live television. I did a little bit of live television, but I was just the conventional board operator. I was not, I was not the primary moving light programmer. And watching those guys work was really, really interesting because they always have 6 different ideas and they always have a stock of things that they know how to do. To a certain extent in educational theater, the things that I do are repetitive ideas. I know what works. I work designs in the same 4 theaters right now because we have 4 high schools, and I know the geography of those theaters and how I can flex that to create different designs. In my role as the auditorium manager, I assist everyone kind of on demand with their musicals. And how much assistance I give is directly related to the experience of the faculty members I'm working with. And so we change staff. We're like everybody else. You know, people come and they stay for 2 years or they stay for 6 years or whatever. You know, there's been a certain amount of turnover in technical theater directors at the high school level because you're asking one human being to do the job of 5 or 6 people in the real world. And that's always a hard thing to get across to school administrations. Like, you're asking this person to teach all these skills simultaneously and perform the design functions, and we hire a whole team of people out there in the real world to do that stuff. But the design language I have, I think, simplified over the years, and I have stopped expecting people to give me kind of very detailed, very technical responses. I've learned to ask, you know, do you like the amount of light on stage? Are you okay that this is making shadows here? Does that bother you? And a lot of times the response I get is, oh God, no, I don't, that's great. Because I'm working with directors who don't necessarily understand what I'm trying to do. They just know that they can see the actors. And to be perfectly honest, in educational theater, a lot of this is can mom and dad see their little baby in the back row? And, you know, like, we have to light a lot of things with our audience in mind. And a lot of times our audience is not a discerning theater audience. They're proud moms and dads, and they bought a ticket so they can see their kid. And that's the job. The job is to make sure that they can see their kid.
Yeah.
And you know, and I'm okay with that.
Yeah. Sometimes you have to give up the design. Yeah.
And then there are moments, though, where I do fight for artistic things.
Right.
Where I'm like, no, wait, just give me a minute. I can work it out. I can work out the timing. I just need to. And then I have to put my educator hat back on and very patiently work with the student to get the result that I know I can get in about 10 keystrokes. But my job is to help this kid get there. And it's important that they go through the process. It's important that we take the time to teach it. It's important that they have that experience of figuring it out, because that's a big part of what we teach.
Right.
We teach these kids that they really can figure it out. So if they can figure this out, they can figure out Medicare. They can figure out how to do their taxes. They can figure out how to solve the problem. That's what I want. And I have to remind myself that I am in an environment where those needs are every bit as important as the needs of the production.
So I got to ask a couple of nerd out questions.
Okay.
how did your brain kind of change and adapt to the advent of accessible and affordable, that's the right word. English is not my first language. Accessible and affordable LEDs. Like, how did that kind of like change how you approached designing and all that kind of stuff?
I don't think they're accessible or affordable.
Well, there are some, I can send you some Amazon links to some that you shouldn't use more than 6 weeks, but yeah, anyway.
Yeah. You know, when I got hired in Irving, they were finishing spending a bond and they were finishing a renovation to some of the fine arts spaces. And because all that was in train when I got hired, that was not part of my job. And I was not consulted, neither was the fine arts director. Well, the fine arts director then didn't know anything about lighting, and he knew that. So he asked. And they bought these awful no-name, made in China, direct from nowhere LEDs and put them in two of our theater spaces and went, look, isn't this wonderful? We got you LED lights. And I turned around and I said, but you didn't buy a controller that will talk to them. You gave me an analog board with sliders. An NSI 1616, I think. And I looked at him and I was like, they sold you this? And he said, yeah, we just took it out of the box. I'm like, that's great. This product was discontinued 5 years ago. They didn't tell you that, did they? And you didn't ask. And so one of the really important things that I was trying to convey to my administrative bosses was, hey guys, somebody has to keep an eye out so we don't get screwed. Okay, because you got completely taken for a ride by this company. And all across Texas, that story is being spread everywhere. And you know, that's unfortunately not new. And I would not say that all the lighting and install companies are unscrupulous, but a lot of them are perfectly willing to unload obsolete stuff on people who are grateful to have it because they don't know that there's something else out there. You know, and that makes me sad for our profession because I think that's unethical. I just do. I think that LED lights are amazing. They have certainly changed the aesthetic.
Right.
And I really call it the in-your-face color aesthetic, where everything is really saturate and everything is kind of neon dance club colors. And that's not my favorite way to light a show. I took my kid to see Hadestown some years ago and absolutely fell in love with the show because for me, it was the first professionally produced show that had an entirely LED lighting rig. And I thought it was beautiful because it had subtleties and they were doing things with LED light that I went, yes, see, these are the other possibilities that we can do. Everything doesn't have to be electric blue and saturated purple and awful yellow. You actually can achieve some really amazing color effects with LED lights. and the flexibility to do all that with just one lighting instrument where you might have needed a whole system to change the color. I mean, I love that.
Yeah.
And the master electrician in me loves that I don't have to physically hang 350 lighting units to light the stage. You know? Right. So, but I don't think that that technology is very affordable for the average school. And I don't know what's going to change that paradigm. It's really hard to justify what that technology costs and how long it lasts. And how long it lasts is directly proportional to who's taking care of it. So I go all around Texas because we have to do the UIL competition.
Right.
And I see all of these schools that were sold elaborate LED lighting packages 10 years ago. And because nobody's ever taken down those lighting units and, I don't know, cleaned out the fans, nothing's working anymore.
Right.
And so they spent $1 million on lighting and they barely got 10 years out of it. And I'm seeing that story happen again and again. So the shelf life of LED technology is not as long as everyone thinks it is. And that's kind of a problem.
Yeah. I've learned that as well.
Yeah. So I don't know. I'm not a huge fan. Like I'm not in my school district. I'm really not advocating for wholesale conversion to LEDs, right. Although we are going to have to do that in two locations because I have, color trend dimension racks in two of my theaters and I am out of parts in North America.
Yeah. You know? Sorry about that. So,
yeah.
That's funny.
So one day those dimmer racks are just going to go boom and we're going to have to start over because right. ETC is not going to make dimmer racks anymore. You're not going to be able to buy that technology.
Right.
And that is a crisis for some of these school districts.
So
you think about, go ahead.
No. Go finish what your thought.
I was going to say that like the ETC has a really great white paper about the benefits of going LED, and even ETC admits that there are scenarios where that is not cost effective. And a lot of these little one horse towns that have one high school, one middle school, one elementary school, not sure that LED lighting is cost effective for them.
Right.
You're not going to buy $2,000 worth of light bulbs for any given lighting fixture in 10 years, but you're going to pay that for an individual lighting fixture. And then you need 50 of those, right? At least. So it's just the technology has just not gotten affordable yet for everybody to play in that sandbox. And I hope that one day it is.
Right. Yeah. It's a kind of a hot take right now. So, but that's good. I like it. That's what I'm here for. So I want to get you out of here on this. And your husband's done a great job of being quiet. It's pretty funny. So as you,
it's all over. I'll tell you what he does.
Yeah. Well, self-proclaimed, you said you got into the education world kind of late, right? Which means you were introduced to one act play kind of late as far as the competition side of things. Maybe not the I'm sure you knew about it before that, but being immersed in it, but so there are people that do leave a profession after decades, right? And they mm-hmm. jump into education, and some of them thrive and some of them dive, you know. What are some tips and tricks that you have, words of advice? You already did a great, you know, 30 minutes of content of, you know, very inspirational stuff. But what is kind of the last thing that you could say that would help encourage somebody thinking about doing this kind of later in the game?
Kids know more than we think they do. They know surprising things. And once you get them over the hump of, yes, you really can do this, you can delegate a lot more than you think. And I spent the first couple years of my life in education sort of refusing to delegate to things and refusing to see students as the resource that they really were. Our student body is much more capable than I think we are trained to think of them. And that was something that I wish I had realized sooner. I think the other thing to recognize is that success looks different from year to year. And sometimes you have to kind of, you have to build that relationship with your administrators early on. I'm on my third principal in my high school. And now Jennifer and I sort of do this conversation together where we kind of slide into the principal's office and we talk about, hey, we're the theater department. So this is kind of what we do. And here's some of the things we really don't do. And sort of setting that expectation of, we're not going to embarrass you with the choice of our show or the kind of production that we do, but what we can do will vary widely from year to year based on the students that we get. And we can do really amazing things if you help us retain the students that we have. I did not, in my very first teaching assignment, focus very much on a kind of team building and that kind of bigs and littles, the, you know, the training, having students training students, in setting up a culture where students sort of have things that they look forward to. And it's really important for our kids to have stuff to look forward to. So that was something that I, you know, I pay a lot of attention to now. In the way that I frame the work that has to be done for the show and the way I frame those crew assignments and the way that I refuse to make those crew assignments early on in the process, because I want them to be a team and I want them to be interchangeable and I want them to know that there are things that they can look forward to and that there are things they can earn. That's important. There is our society is a structure. And you have to, when I was in high school, there was a very clear progression of how you got to one of those coveted running the show jobs. And I like to make those expectations very clear to my students. I was not good at that the first few years I was teaching. And I think it's really, really important to pay attention to that. When I worked in the Stagehands Union, that was kind of amorphous. That idea of how do you get ahead? Well, it's who you know. In high school, it can't work that way. You can't have that sort of guild hall mentality. you have to invest in some different things. And that was interesting. And then as far as I'm concerned, the whole school is my playground. The whole school is my resource. So I love that I can go to the EMTs and say, you know, we're doing the show and it's in a hospital. Can I borrow one of the hospital beds? Cool, you know, that I can go to the art department and say, I need this thing painted. I need marble done. Can somebody come down and marble stairs for me? And it's not because I don't have time. It's because I need the kids to see that level of interdepartment cooperation, because that's what's going to get them through their lives. We have to know how to ask people to do things. We have to know how to assess what other skills other people can bring us. And that's, to me, the miracle of the theater. Everybody comes to the theater to do everything, you know. When I taught Theater One, I have kids who are like, no, I don't want to stand up and I can't memorize. I'm like, you know what we do in the theater, kid? We write, we sing, we dance, we play. We do all that stuff here. There is something here that you can do well. You just don't know what it is yet. We're going to figure that out.
Minor Wisdom.